On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Yes, we have made it to the end of the week, and yes, it is Friday the 13th, but there is absolutely nothing to be afraid of, because we know what Friday the 13th is bad for. It's bad for French kings who execute former crusaders. Yeah, that's what Friday the 13th, nobody else needs to really worry. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you'll find entrance to the chat room. Room has Lottie and Sparky and Waggy and Jan and me in it so far. More will be coming. Thank you, Randy. Loud and clear on iTunes. Appreciated. Much appreciated. Because apart from looking at my output monitor on the streaming device, I don't have any way of knowing how reception is. So thank you very much. Also at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, you'll find our Listen live stream, which is where you can go to check and make sure, right, unless you're on a Mac, because I think it's Windows Media Player based, but whatever. You can also listen on your tablet, your iDevice, your smart device, by using apps such as TuneIn Radio or Stitcher Internet Radio, who will play ads for you, for which we get no pay whatsoever. Thank you, Jeremy. Sounds great on Android and TuneIn. Makes a great travel buddy, Jeremy says. That's true. Now, also at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, you can find the ever-present PayPal button and the ever-present traditional overland mail address. That address, of course, is The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, BECKLEYWV 25801. And a reminder, checks and money orders should not be made payable to yours truly, but rather to The Horn or Head On Communications, because that's how we get the bills paid. Credit union account, boss man Wayne, write check. There we go. And, of course, fundraising continues perpetually here. We were very kindly helped out at the beginning, Wednesday, by our buddy Scott, and by Waggy, who took care of a couple of days of fundraising. That leaves us finding ourselves back at it this evening. We had help from Sal and from Karen along the way yesterday. Today we have had help from Jeremy and from Thomas, who has been rather busy in his own right this afternoon. I suspect is on his way to visit Bill, Mr. Stress, up in the Cleveland area. But before he left, he helped out. So that means that this evening we need to raise only $115 further to stay even with where we need to be at any given point in any given month, so that there can be another month of The Horn come January. So $115, you know, 10, 11 people, $10, etc. You know, it's how we keep it going. And I mentioned Mr. Stress, Bill. I talked to him earlier today. I called him, and I think Kevin in Colorado has also spoken with him yesterday. I talked to him earlier today. We communicated nicely. He recognized me, which was really important. And talked a little bit to the nursing staff. Not a lot of details coming that way, because there's really no way to do that from a legal standpoint, but Bill is cognizant and conscious and capable of rational thought. I think he probably will be needing some rehab. One thing that I think will be very important for all of you to know is that I was able to secure enough information to find out that social services staff is in fact working on his move, so that he will not, and because he's still worrying about that. I'm not the praying about anything kind of guy, and really I don't believe in any deities that are out there working the lightning bolt circuit, but if there were, the people that caused Bill so much consternation are certainly deserving of one right up a keister, because that's what he was worrying about and really, really worrying about before the incident happened, and something that he was talking to me about this afternoon. It is an object lesson in not shitting on your fellow human being simply because you have the means and the ability to do so. Right? Yeah. So many of you have sent your fondest wishes, and I've started and best thoughts toward Bill, and I've started a list of all of you, and will transmit those so that he can see that people literally all over this little blue marble time machine hurtling through the universe are rooting for him, and it will mean a lot to him. So thank you. Thank you very much. It has been it's been a learning experience in the degree of caring that obtains in this little community that we together have built and which you keep going, that there is so much goodwill out there. So it's 7 minutes past 6 p.m. here in the Eastern Standard Time Zone. The studio is beginning to fill up with the noxious fumes from my various and sundry neighbors' coal-fired stoves. It is not brutally cold out there, but it will get nasty out there. We're looking for temperatures, overnight temperatures over the weekend, dropping into the mid-teens. We're looking for more snow. I remember back in the salad days of October, reading something about how the old Farmer's Almanac said we were supposed to get a milder-than-usual winter. Bullshit, at least thus far. And Jug of Punch has just popped into the chat room and says, "Howdy, everyone. I just arrived at the hospital." So he'll be going to see Bill in short order. And I think he's even going to try to use a mobile device to hook up the program so that Bill can be listening in. Oh, yeah, Jeremy says, "Add me to the list of people who are rooting for Bill." Oh, you've been on the list, Jeremy, without a doubt. Yeah, I should probably quit my whining. Lottie says that it's expected to be around -6 Fahrenheit on Monday up there in the general Boston area where Lottie lives. Oh, okay, you're already with. Okay, I heard you, Bob. Awesome. Isn't it neat that internet radio is coming into its own, making the future into the present? Jug of Punch just took internet radio to the hospital with him. And I bet the audio is better than it ever was on some tinny speakered little hold it up to your ear AM transistor radio. Yep, Marty, you're on the list. So, it is Friday on the front porch, first of all. And just a general advisory. If you would like to participate in Friday on the front porch, there are, of course, always the traditional traditional phone lines, 304-658-3333. We'll open them up here in a little bit. But there's only four of those. On the other hand, we can get lots and lots of people into the Friday on the Front Porch conversation over in the Skype Horn Malloy chat group that is moderated and has been for yea verily many a year now by the intrepid Sparky, also known as Duncan. And if you will, if you want to join in on it, just shoot me a note. I'll send it on over to Duncan, and he'll add you to his friends list, and you'll be part of the conversation. It's not as complicated as it sounds. I got a couple of burrs under my saddle this afternoon, and we'll get them out of the way. Maybe discuss them further. Oh! Update. Healthcare.gov website update. I got all the way to the end. It took me four tries last night, but I got all the way to the end with no crashes. And I've since figured out that because, you know, you'd save and continue. And then after it crashed, you go back and you try to start over, and it gives you a screen that says, do you have dependents? Now, meanwhile, it's showing me that Agnes and our kids are listed down the side. So, yes, I have dependents. And then it says, put in a name. So you put in a name of one of your dependents, and it replicates your child for you. Yes, it really does. So start over. Go through it again. Crash. Go back. Do you have dependents? No. And then it says, damn it, please check the box that says you do. No. Check the box. No. Check the box. No. Won't go anywhere if you don't check the box, and then if you check the box, your children get cloned. Thank you, CGI and Booz Allen Hamilton. The same folks who wanted to spend $1 billion to spy on World of Warcraft and the folks over at Second Life. Jesus. So I got all the way to the verify your personal personality thing last night, and ho, we crashed again. Please try again later. So I went back in, and that's where we learned about the part about cloning your children. And I looked at Ferg, and I said, you know, part of being a semi-enlightened human being is knowing when you're licked. So I said, screw it. And instead, he and I just sat and watched a really good film. I liked it a lot. In fact, he turned me on to it. Kind of an all-star cast. Well, all-star cast. Kenneth Branagh as Laurence Olivier, no less. And Dame Judi Dench and a number of others in a film called My Week with Marilyn. And it is simply a charming watched it over on one of those online streaming affairs. A really, really good little movie. And Kenneth Branagh, after a while, you're convinced that he is Laurence Olivier. Irish Dave wanting to know, so what are the tax implications of cloning your dependents at hell.gov? I'm sure they could probably send you to Guantanamo for doing it, which is why I wound up just deleting the whole damn thing again and again and again and starting over. But, update, shortly before airtime this evening, I think I actually completed the process. I think. Because I can only guess. You know, even back in the days of Nintendo and stuff, when you finished Donkey Kong, Mario or Luigi or who the hell ever at least got a little kiss from the princess. to let you know that you'd finally won. Not so much with the healthcare.gov ACA application website. I just kind of have to guess. I think at this point, given what a nightmare it is, there should probably be some sort of graphic. You know, they could probably use something from the software for effing Pong or something to just to let you know, near, you know, you win. But no. So now I'm either going to have health care or I'm not. And Jay writes in, he says, add me to the list of good wishes to Bill. But wait, there's more. This just in time for next week's Wednesday's program. The federal courts have ordered that the Mount Soledad Cross north of San Diego be removed from public federal land. In 1991, the Ninth Circuit ordered the cross removed. After 25 years of appeals and counterappeals, the end may be nearing. Yesterday, the Supreme Court declined to take the case, which makes the Ninth Circuit's decision final. Following that, U.S. District Judge Larry Burns has ordered that the cross be removed within 90 days, but stayed the order pending a forthcoming appeal by the government. Let the wailing and gnashing of Christian teeth proceed. They're persecuting us! Oh, Jeebus! Yeah, you can hear it now, can't you? Thank you for the update, Jay. Last I heard on this is, the cross stays, the court hath spoken. Okay, good question in from Randy. How did you sort the Roman numeral 2 versus junior problem on the ACA website? A long time ago, when I had a career that was unfolding in front of me and was a vain, much more vain man than I am now, and considerably younger, going all the way back to days in college. Once upon a time in college, I actually pulled the fold-out of an ad for a Porsche 944 out of a magazine, it was Esquire, and pinned it on my wall as a sort of inspiration to go forth and study hard and do well. Well, fast forward, and some years later, it was used, significantly used, but I got my Porsche 944. It was fun. And I was all dedicated to changing my own oil and everything. Until I went to do it. And the first time I changed my oil, it appeared to me that in order to successfully change one's own oil without having a lift in one's garage, one would have to remove the distributor cap, which I did. But then I learned to think like, or pretended I learned to think, like a German engineer. And I realized, because it, no matter what you did, the space was not big enough to get the oil filter out from either the top or the bottom of the engine compartment because there was crap in the way. And so a buddy of mine, we were talking, he said, wait, you've never had one of these before, have you? I said, no. He said, you have to learn to think like a German engineer. And so there was a long space of Zen-like time spent just staring under the hood of that magnificent piece of Guards Red machinery. And eventually I noticed that the pop-up headlights had an armature that also had a manual override to them, and that if you hit the manual override, the lights would pop up but not come on, but the armature would go out of the way and you could bring the filter up through. And I went, well, son of a gun. And I say that not as some sort of lesson in Porsche mechanics, because I'm certainly not capable or competent to give them, but more in the way of answering Randy's question, how did you get around the... Well, what I did is I finally punted, and I just started saying yes, yes, 1,000 times yes, Yes, this is his name as it appears on his Social Security card. Yes! And maybe, just maybe, that was successful. So that's the abbreviated version of how I did that. But with healthcare in mind, you know, I get these right-wing press release pitches constantly, and sometimes I write back, you know, like when their grammar's terrible or they're, you know, showing themselves to be the teabaggers that they are, things like that. Spelling Constitution or Jesus is the Antichrist or, you know, Obama is the Antichrist. You know, things that teabaggers do because they're really, really awfully stupid. And I got one today from my buddy Levi over at Americans for Prosperity, who wanted me to know, happy holidays with Obamacare number 6. Medicaid expansion provides poor health care and spikes federal spending. And being someone who has no health insurance and who has real hopes of someday having either some sort of low-rent for-profit health insurance or, my preference, a form of universal single-payer health care insurance, which is, in fact, Medicaid. I read it. Today, Americans for Prosperity continued its 3 weeks of Obamacare's problems campaign. Remember, Americans for Prosperity is the sort of death star of teabaggery. Heavy funding from all manner of, you know, filthy right-wing oligarchic, kleptocratic, sick freaks. Today, Americans for Prosperity continued its 3 weeks of Obamacare's problems campaign by responding to the administration's praise of Medicaid expansion. The White House is expected to focus on this topic today as part of its 3-week pro-Obamacare tour. Medicaid is not a... Wait a minute, I think we need our Charlton Heston for this one. Medicaid is not a program worth praising. It has a track record of providing unacceptably poor quality health care, and yet Obamacare forces millions of Americans into the broken system while costing states billions of taxpayer dollars. Only it doesn't. Remember, the first part of the Medicaid expansion is paid for 100% by the federal government. The lowest it can ever drop to is 90%, meaning that the states are on the hook for 10% of their Medicaid budget, which is a whopping lower number than they were ever responsible for before. Because Medicaid reimburses doctors at rates 34% lower than private insurance, Medicaid limits its patients to a two-tiered system of health care that restricts their access to quality care. This presumes that people have Medicaid. Because you can only talk about this in the universe of people who have Medicaid versus people who have for-profit health care insurance. Or something. You cannot talk about people having better health care who have no effing insurance at all. And apparently what got my buddy Levi's maiden forms in a bunch was a survey abstract that came from the American Surgical Association, which bills itself as the oldest surgical association in the United States, established in 1880. So this is nothing that Rand Paul invented to certify himself, apparently. So here are the results of the American Surgical Association analysis of outcomes based upon what kind of coverage one has. Objectives. Now let's see. Especially those of you who are good with statistics and good with analysis and good with science, just be thinking as I'm reading, okay? Because we already know how the teabaggers think. Old Levi over there at Americans for Prosperity, he thinks that that these numbers mean that Medicaid really sucks. Okay? So here's the abstract of the study. We don't get the whole study, just the abstract. Medicaid and uninsured populations are a significant focus of current health care reform. We hypothesized that outcomes following major surgical operations in the United States is dependent on primary payer status. Time out. This made its way all the way to publication by the American Surgical Association, the oldest surgical association in the United States, established in 1880. And they can't even get the subject and the verb to agree in their objective sentence. Now, I'm not trying to be a grammar goober about this, but these are people with... I mean, we're talking about Damien J. Lepar, or maybe it's J. Lepar Damien, Castigliano M. Bamadipati, Carlos M. Mary, George J. Stuckenborg, David R. Jones, Bruce D. Shermer, Irving L. Cron, M.D., Gaurav Aliwadi, M.D., University of Virginia, Charlottesville, Virginia, which prides itself on being a really, really hoity-toity freaking state-supported school. Let's read that objective again. Medicaid and uninsured populations are a significant focus of current health care reform. Good job, guys! We hypothesized that outcomes following major surgical operations in the United States is dependent on primary payer status. You know, Shakespeare loved this kind of thing. In Henry V, toward the end, when all the blood and gore and guts have been mopped up off the stage, and Henry V is courting the daughter of the French king so as to bring the two thrones together in the next generation that would be Henry VI, and well, that didn't work out so well. But anyway, that's probably because Henry V was a religious maniac who died young. There's a scene where the French princess, who does not speak much in the way of good English, is meeting with Henry, whose French is not much better than the princess's English, and the only one who can translate is a comic nurse, maid, duenna, whatever you want to call her. Shakespeare liked funny nurses. It held true all the way up to Hee-Haw. And there's this one line where the French princess says something, and Henry says, "I didn't quite catch that." And the nurse says, "She says the tongues of the men's is full of deceits." That was a real knee slapper for the folks who paid to sit down on the benches at the Globe Theater as opposed to stand in the pit there and wait for the sight gags. So the second sentence of the objective of the University of Virginia study says, "We hypothesize that outcomes following major surgical operations in the United States is dependent on primary payer status." Their hypothesis was that if you had the highfalutin for-profit insurance and coming from a state like the Old Dominion, I can see them just jumping at this hypothesis. Yeah, we'll argue that if you got you some for-profit insurance, you're going to have a better outcomes than if you got the government communist socialist insurance. So these overeducated assholes can't even get the second sentence right. They can't get their subject and their verb to agree. Yeah, that's what happens when you turn education into a trade school approach as opposed to a multi-layered liberal arts whole person approach. you wind up with outcomes is dependent. I can hand this over to the ghost of my mother, who will take about 15 seconds to read it and begin chuckling at it, hand it over to the ghost of my father, who will take another 15 seconds to read it, and then will remark, "These people couldn't get out of Minnie Lee Hugert's ninth grade journalism class. Because they couldn't." So anyway, we know what their outcomes is. Methods. From 2003 to 2007, 893,658 major surgical operations were evaluated using the nationwide inpatient sample database. And here, okay, talk about, Jesus Christ, talk about salting the sample. Here's what they sampled. Here are the operations they sampled in which they decided you would be better off to have for-profit insurance than, you know, the Medicaid. Lung resection, esophagectomy, colectomy, pancreatectomy, gastrectomy, abdominal aortic aneurysm repair, hip replacement, and coronary artery bypass. Into which none of those you go thinking, well, I'll be okay tomorrow. Most of those you go into them, and I'm thinking particularly in the case of the abdominal aortic aneurysm repair, you go in thinking, the will's all right, had the nice talk with the grim man at the funeral home, made my peace with my deity or lack of one. Okay, that's good. All right, honey, check with me tomorrow and you will find me a grave fellow. So they found some of the creepiest operations with some of the creepiest outcomes possible, and they wanted to find out if having Medicaid meant you die. Results! Oh, wait. Patients were stratified by primary payer status. Medicare, N equals 491,829. Medicaid, N equals 40,259. So you've got roughly 10 times as many Medicare patients as Medicaid patients. Private insurance, N equals 337,535. So what, about 8 times as many for-profit insurance patients as Medicaid patients. And uninsured, N equals 24,035, which is less even than the Medicaid sample, because they don't go to the hospital in the first effing place. Multivariate regression models were applied to assess outcomes. These are things you learn about in statistics class. I never had statistics class. Results. Unadjusted, at least understand, yeah, I'm a long-time knower of words. Studied the art of word knowing for quite some time now. Unadjusted mortality for Medicare, 4.4%, or equals 3.51. Medicaid, 3.7%, OR 2.86, and uninsured, 3.2%, OR 2.51. Patient groups were higher compared to private insurance groups, 1.3%, P is less than 0.001. Moreover, mortality was lowest for private insurance patients, independent of operations. Mortality meaning death! So, of the 337,535 people who had for-profit insurance, fewer of them died on a statistical basis than people who had Medicare or Medicaid or were uninsured. Moreover, mortality was lowest for private insurance patients independent of operation. Importantly, after controlling for age, gender, income, geographic region, operation, and 30 comorbid conditions, Medicaid payer status was associated with the longest length of stay and highest total cost, P less than 0.0001. In addition, Medicaid and uninsured payer status independently conferred the highest adjusted risks of mortality. So, as between, so here's the outcome. In hospital mortality, you die in the hospital. 1.97 for Medicaid, 1.74 for uninsured, 1.54 for Medicare, and private insurance just says REF, meaning it was the reference standard. Length of stay, 10.49. Medicaid, uninsured, 7.01. Medicare, 8.77. Private insurance, 7.38. So they got the uninsured people out fastest. Screw you. We don't care if you're well. Get out. The machine that goes ping says you must leave. Conclusions. Medicaid and uninsured payer status confers increased risk of adjusted mortality. Medicaid was further associated with the greatest adjusted length of stay and total cost despite risk factors or operation. Possible explanations include delays in access to care or disparate differences in health maintenance. Interesting. One of the conclusions does not include Medicaid is a Kenyan Muslim socialist conspiracy to make us all anti-colonialist haters of white people. Which, of course, is the thesis of the fine folks over at Americans for Prosperity. That's what they referenced, the University of Virginia study. They also, and I love this sentence, an Oregon study concluded that Medicaid coverage offered no significant benefit to the health of program participants versus being uninsured, except for the fact of, you know, dying outside the hospital. Huh. How about that? Just got a note from Randy in PA. REF sometimes refers to an error in a cell formula in an Excel spreadsheet. Well, dip me. So you get the idea. There is no part of the Affordable Care Act that these merciless pricks over at the Americans for Prosperity teabagging central think is a good idea, unless you're just giving away more money to the for-profit insurance industry. I got an idea. How about let's compare these outcomes with, say, Sweden, Britain, Canada, Cuba? Oh, no, they don't dare do that. Because guess what happens with the for-profit insurance healthcare industry then? They lose! So, thank you to my buddy Levi at Americans for Prosperity, where if Brown won't do it, by God, Browning will, in a picture of a gun. And Obama is the Antichrist. Note coming in from Jan in the UK. Subject line, apology. I hope I didn't upset any toilet brushes listening last night. If so, I apologize. Please send best wishes to Bill from the UK listeners, and I absolutely will, Jan. Thank you very much. Diane noting, Bob, please add me to the list of people who wish Mr. Stress well. Signed, Diane in Kansas Stan. Done, Diane. Tim from L.A. Asking what he perceives to be a stupid question, but isn't one, because there's no such thing, unless it's a question like, don't you think the Tea Party really has the answer for America? That's a stupid question, but that's not the question that Tim asked. What is the difference between junior and two Roman numerals? Apparently the functionality of the healthcare.gov website, no. That's unfair. The difference is, I was later informed after we'd already made our choice with naming our new baby, that if one is naming somebody with someone else's name and the someone else's name is not their father, you use the Roman numeral 2. So let's say we got me, and then we had named the baby Frederick Ferdinand Salathiel Ozias Minnis, right? And then he has a son and wants to name him after me, that kid would be the second. Like I said, when I capitulated and agreed to name our son after me, I did so with the insistence that we use the Roman numeral 2, because every junior in my family line for the last 8 generations has died young. And I'm, despite my cold, cool rationality, occasionally subject to fits of absolute paranoid superstition. So that's the difference, Tim. And Irish Dave has it right. The only foolish question is the unasked one. Unless it has to do with whether or not teabaggers have the real answers for America. I'm gonna plant my flag and fight my war on that hill, Dave. I'm sorry. Dave says, I can understand, did they study breast augmentation, these guys? I can understand they would pass up the study of the rarely performed optic rectomy to sever the optic nerve from the anus, thereby solving the problem of shitty outlook. Had to go a long way for that one, but it was worth the giggle. Dave says, adjusted mortality? You mean like half dead? No, it seems that the Americans for Prosperity's teabagging solution to the problem is to just admit that what Alan Grayson said a few years ago is true. These right-wingers, these conservatives, these libertarians, these teabaggers, these birchers, these deathers, these tempters, these booger-eaters would prefer that you die. And if you do die, die quickly. And going back to what Jan asked a minute ago, I hope I didn't upset any toilet brushes listening last night. A note from Jeremy. I think we all learned yesterday, as taught by Megyn Kelly, all we need to ask with anything in our lives is, what would white Jesus do? Which brings me to a separate topic altogether. Only it's not a separate topic, it's more like a return to last night. Oddly enough, after being eviscerated on the internet web tubes, it's not a big truck, over her white Jesus, white Santa Klan ladies auxiliary moment. She missed her show last night. Apparently, did Fox pull her? We don't know. Did Roger Ailes call her into her office and say, listen, honey, we pay you to be cute. We don't pay you to be smart. Don't sit there and tell me about your damn law degree. You're going to take the night off, sweetheart. And so she did. Apparently, however, tonight, on whatever program she's on there on Radio Rwanda, she will be discussing why she declared that Jesus and Santa were historically white. Ooh, goody. Irish Dave noting, it is intuitively obvious to the most casual observer that the Surgical Association is a white man. Yes. So, once again, the folks at Radio Rwanda have ginned up a way to get people to tune in to her otherwise unwatchable program to hear her probably still not learn the first law of holes. She's probably still hollering for a bigger shovel to dig with which to dig. But anyway, it did. It caught a lot of attention. We had our moments of fun. I created that hashtag OtherHistoricWhitePPL. And my favorite for last night was White Malcolm X by any means necessary. White by any means necessary. I thought my own other historic white people Mandingo was pretty good. But John Stewart, bless his heart, John Stewart absolutely gutted her like a carp. Let's check in. I don't play John Stewart clips very often, and so you can probably guess that I have a pretty damn good reason for it.
For all you kids watching at home, Santa just is white, but this person is just arguing that maybe we should also have a black Santa. But, you know, Santa is what he is, and just so you know, we're just debating this because someone wrote about it, kids.
It just got real. Santa is just white. And who are you actually talking to? Children who are sophisticated enough to be watching a news channel at 10 o'clock at night, yet innocent enough to still believe Santa Claus is real, yet racist enough to be freaked out.
See, this is hilarious. This is the kind of stuff you go to Jon Stewart for. The 15-second, 10-count eye roll while the audience convulses in spasms of laughter. This is the man operating at the absolute apex of his talent. I mean, he takes that one. This is, you know, we're just, granted, if you have to explain a joke, it's not funny anymore, but I think sometimes an analysis of why comedy is funny is beneficial. I can never be this funny. I don't really try. But I can't. I can't be this funny because the genius lies in taking one thing, you kids watching at home on a program that starts at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, okay, and is repeated for the Pacific Coast audience, you know, at what, midnight? Midnight Eastern, 9 Pacific? Or maybe she's just on at 6 p.m. Pacific, in which case, maybe, I don't know. But just taking the fact that she made a reference to children in the midst of her racist psychobabble and then eviscerating it is brilliant. Let's check it again.
A Christmas nog.
So in Slate, they have a piece on .com. Santa Claus should not be a white man anymore. By the way, for all you kids watching at home, Santa just is white, but this person is just arguing that maybe we should also have a black Santa. But, you know, Santa is what he is, and just so you know, we're just debating this because someone wrote about it, kids.
Just got real. Santa is just white. And who are you actually talking to? Children who are sophisticated enough to be watching a news channel at 10 o'clock at night, yet innocent enough to still believe Santa Claus is real, yet racist enough to be freaked out if he isn't white. Why?
Genius.
That's such a narrow... Yes, West Virginia, there is a Santa Claus.
Go fuck yourself, John Stewart, with a red-hot flaming poker. Yes, West Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. That's right. We'll take the most beaten down, bedraggled, hopeless, futureless, abused, poisoned, blasted, killed state in the Union So John's and use it as the butt of a joke for John Stewart to make ha-ha funny for the folks in his audience at home. Oh, calm down, Bob. He skewers everybody now and then. A baby born in the mountaintop removal regions of Appalachia has a greater chance of being born with a birth defect than any child that will be born just about anywhere else in the United States. Those are the facts. So having asked the question, what kind of racist children was Megyn Kelly addressing herself to? John Stewart answers his own question by saying, the poisoned, birth-defected, blasted, neglected, poor, hungry, ill-educated children of West Virginia. He said that. The real world impact is that he said that about my 6-year-old granddaughter, who hasn't a mean bone in her body, who doesn't know the meaning of racism. He said that about my 5-year-old grandson, who has never heard the N-word in his life. He said that about my 4-year-old grandson, who only wants to sit and talk into Opa's microphone and listen to his own voice. Yes, West Virginia has a racism problem. But racism and other oppressive problems are born out of assumptions that everyone in some place, in some region, of some skin tone, of some characteristic, are all alike. And he, in apparently attempting to decry the racism of Megyn Kelly, did the same goddamn thing that she did. Now, I will leave it to you. This program is not an entertainment. I hope never to say, my friends, I'm just a comedian. I'm only an entertainer. You should never take me seriously. Take me seriously or don't take me seriously. Take me any way you wish. But all I can do is tell you that when I saw that, and when I heard that audience erupt into paroxysms of laughter, I wasn't angry. I was hurt. Yes, this state, by virtue of a study we have talked about on this program, was listed as the most racist state in the Union. Yes. Yes, I hear that particular epithet, that filthy, filthy word, more often than I care to. But my beloved wife and I have busted our asses to make sure that ours never use it. That ours were raised right, as we say. But F it, right? I mean, John Stewart's got to have somebody to make his fun off of. Might as well be us. Hey, John. You know how you took that vacation to go make your movie in Iran? Take another one. Hell, we'll find you a TV studio in Charleston. You don't even have to leave the air. You can broadcast every night. But come on down. Come on down, John Stewart. Come on down and live beneath a mountaintop removal site. Bring your kids, John. You got kids? You got kid? Bring it. Bring your adoring spouse. Move in. Live up near Maria Gano at Bob White, or find yourself a nice place on Peachtree near my buddy Bo Webb. Come on, Stuart! Breathe the poison day in and day out. Wonder with every trip to the doctor when they're going to get that somber look on their face and say, "You've got the cancer, son." Come on, John. Because we're just a great goddamn big joke. It's funny when people die, isn't it, Stuart? You know, Stuart, the funerals are where the real laugh riots are. Fuck. Uh-oh. Sorry. Lost it. Break time. This is the horn. We'll be starting Friday on the front porch just any time now. I hope. I'm Bob Confetti. This is for you, a long-distance dedication.
Hey.
For Megyn Kelly.
You know what I found you last night. Just when Mama turned out the light, I went in the living room to see what the noise that woke up me. And I was drawn by the Christmas tree. Ooh. Santa Claus is a black man.
The black man. What happened, Aunt Kim?
Well, I saw Santa Claus, and do you know what?
What, a Kimmy?
He looked a lot like you. He was handsome.
I can dig it.
He was black.
Right on.
He had an afro. He was really out of sight. Now I'm going to tell everybody that I saw Santa.
Well, that's pretty cool.
Santa Claus is a black man.
Right at 2 minutes past the hour as we move through this Friday on the front porch. Couple of emails. Marty noting, your grandchildren might never have done anything to deserve what Stewart implied. Are you defending those other 4 to 6 year olds who might be saying it aloud around your grandkids? Nope. But that's not the point. The point is, John Stewart, and Asa points out, you know, people write stuff for him. But he's the, you know, he's ultimately responsible. They have meetings, and you go, nope, not funny enough. Funny enough, not funny enough. Oh, no, nah, a little too edgy, don't think we should. And that's that, there's a process there. And so it is not the same as saying that I absolve the racism that exists in this state, because it is very much real. But to say that all West Virginians are racist, which is what he said, is not even remotely acceptable, and frankly, in the language that I've learned over the years, is in itself oppressive conduct. Luda says by email, I feel you. That's the way we feel in South Dakota. The media is always crapping on us. No one cares about the Dakotas and so forth. And I get upset like that whenever they do it. Irish Dave noting, I don't have to tell you that New Jersey is now racism free. Oh, yeah. He also said, Stewart's from Jersey. It's not his fault. See? No, I'm sorry. I'm sensitive to that kind of thing. It is mean, it is spiteful, and it is hurtful. Irish Dave wants to know, is John Stewart's amigo Carlos Danger a white man historically? Yeah. Yeah. Luda also pointing out, famous white folk, or, you know, other historic white people. Sitting Bull, America's white founding father. Those, Jesus. It's just disappointing. Disappointing. Because there are a ton of people in this state who are working hard. To erase many of the negative stereotypes that afflict this state and this region. Granted, we have to climb uphill a significant part of the way. And it's not just racist stereotypes, it's other stereotypes. ignorance. Remember when the National Mining Association said that the birth defect study in West Virginia was invalid because the people doing the study hadn't taken into account the fact that West Virginians and Appalachian people can't resist having sex with their own kinfolk? And I think that's why it is particularly so ignoring or so annoying, because it is bad enough that the really nasty, hateful people do it, when I want badly to believe that John Stewart and his staff are not that nasty and that hateful. And yet with moments like this, they prove that they are. 6 minutes past the hour. We are still looking to raise $115 to finish off fundraising for the week. 11 folks, $10. 22 folks, $5. We're rounding now. However it happens. PayPal button or overland traditional mail. Let's get started with Friday on the Front Porch. See who we got. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello? Hello? Anybody? We'll just put that line back on hold for a little bit. Not sure what's going on. If you're on, if you heard me and I didn't hear you, shoot me an email. Let me know. Try the other line. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
Hey, Jim.
It's me, just going to be a member if you'll have me for the confab.
All right, stand by. Let me bring the Skype gang on.
Okay, thanks, sir.
Skype group roll call. We got Duncan. We got Kathy. You there, Kathy?
I just added her to the group tonight, so I don't know what's up.
Okay. We got Jason.
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, and we got two people whose names I can't see.
Todd and Kathy.
Oh, well, Kathy I see, and I guess the other one's Todd, but is that sentient?
There you go.
Waggy.
Oh, that's Waggy. Okay, hey, Waggy.
Hello.
All right, so welcome to Friday on the Front Porch, everybody. And let's see, let me bring on another phone line. Hey, who we got?
This is Jim.
Hey, Jim, how are you?
All right, how's it going?
Okay, so we got Jim 1 and Jim 2. West Virginia Jim, you'll be Jim 1 tonight. Louisiana Stan Jim, you'll be Jim 2.
Thanks, sir.
Fine with me.
All right. Hey, thanks to Sal for helping out this evening. We are we are another step along the way. Much appreciated. Jan in Vegas notes, John Stewart, this is from the chat room, John Stewart is responsible for what he says, and he also misquoted the saying anyway, so it was hateful. Yeah, well, that was the whole point. That was the comedy part of it, Jan. The old line is, yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. So he turned it on its ear and said, yes, West Virginia, there's a white Santa Claus, right? Because, you know. I guess it's just not fair to say Mississippi or Alabama or South Carolina or Tennessee or Kentucky or...
But don't forget Louisiana.
Yeah.
Well, he was trying to stay to the original quote as much as he could, I would imagine.
Yeah, that was, you know, the insertion of West in front of Virginia was the funny.
I know. When I was watching it live last night, and when I heard that, I cringed, and I go, I'm sure Bob's going to have something to say about this tomorrow.
Well, I mean, I don't run around trying to just, you know, wear my feelings on my sleeve. But I mean, isn't that a little over the top? What he did?
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't matter who he used; it would have been over the top compared to a state. He's making a reference that all the kids in that state are watching Fox News, which they're not. At that hour.
Right. And that was part of the funny, too. You know, in other words, no children are watching. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe we can overthink that or, yeah. But it just kind of stunk at the very beginning.
Yeah. Change the subject a little bit. You went back to all those procedures.
Yes.
I got one for you. Lumbar laminectomy.
Yeah, I know about those. Those are real parties, aren't they?
Yeah, I had one the day after 9/11.
And what did they tell you? At the time you had it, Duncan, what did they tell you? The success rate's around 50-50?
Well, the doctor I had, I knew his success rate was really good. But he did tell me, he says, you know, I could kill you doing this, or paralyze you, or something else, you know. There could be a lot of things that go wrong with it. Because they are working on your spine.
Just one sec here. Okay, I got somebody trying to join the trying to join the Skype group, trying to come through me, and it can't happen that way. Not that I know of.
No, I got to have his contact name.
Yeah. So just contact. Just look up Duncan Cunningham on Skype, right?
No, it's Sparky Dunk.
I mean Sparky Dunk.
Sparky
okay.
Dunk.
My bad. Sorry.
Same thing I use in the chat room.
Okay, Sparky Dunk on Skype, and send a friend request, and bang, there you are. And let's see, a couple more folks to bring on. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello?
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Jeremy, what's up?
Not much, you?
Oh, not a lot. Let's see, one more line. Stand by. Oh, there's Kathy. And one more line.
Hey, hi, how are you doing?
I'm well. Who have I got on the phone line? I just brought somebody on the phone line. Don't
this
know who.
Is Kathy. Oh.
Kathy, are you on the traditional phone or are you on Skype?
She's Skype. On Skype.
Okay, so, all right, let's try this again. Maybe it'll work.
Actually, I'm Todd's in Skype right now.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm sitting here doing 16 things at one time, so...
So Todd is Kathy now?
Well, we're trying to get Kathy in, so I'm Todd right now. Todd's working on me.
You need two computers.
We have two computers.
Okay, well, I can add the other one as you. If you want.
All right, who have I got on the phone line
right
now?
Now so.
Okay.
I just brought somebody in on the phone line.
Yes, this is Jeff. How are you?
I'm well, Jeff. Good to hear from you. Welcome to Friday on the Front Porch.
Thank you. It's Friday on the Front Porch, probably damn cold where you are.
Not as bad as it has been, but it'll get worse.
We're down here in old...
Oh, wait, you punted and retreated to Florida, didn't you?
Yeah, we can't... I'm a fan of the son of a bitch. I can't take the cold weather. But Susan just found some nice poems. And I sent them, if you have the time, and she could read them. It fits into your stuff if you want to bother with that. But it would be sort of poetry reading to break into the other stuff, but it's up to you. But before you say yes or no, I was listening to your podcast or your yesterday's programming and talking about the, that exotic website that we produced for healthcare.
Yes,
and the woman who was you were talking with, she was very knowledgeable, and of course loved the idea that we have great health care now. But she was really upset, and so were you with the way the website's been running.
And of course, it all arises from the fact that it's being run for profit.
Well, you just walked into my concept, and which I didn't want to do. But yeah, if you were right, if you started from birth and everybody had free or had an inalienable right to health care, that's an inalienable right. Part of education, health care, food, which is clean air, clean water, and clean soil, that's all inalienable rights. And that's the things we should be thinking about. How do we change this to an inalienable right situation and not a for-profit situation?
If you're talking about rights-based stuff, I think you'd almost have to amend the Constitution. Because Medicare is not... hey, Jim, jump in on this. That would be Jim 1. Even Medicare is not a constitutional right, correct?
No, sir.
You see, we didn't put... There's a lot of things not put into the Constitution because, as Dr. Bill said, the Constitution was written by very wealthy... a few fat guys, white fat guys, who weren't really to give a damn about human rights. They just wrote the Constitution to make sure that the economic system worked for the wealthy. And it was when before away from England, it was the same problem, though.
Yeah, I'm getting at this from a procedural standpoint, not a philosophical one, Jeff. So if you say that if you try to establish something as a right, it is going to be, since it is not a criminal right, it will be a civil right, and in order to make it a civil right, the Constitution will have to be amended. Thus, it is probably simpler to go at it from simply a legislative approach.
Wow. I don't know about that, because actually the Constitution is a bill of negative rights affecting the government. It's something, the Bill of Rights is something they cannot take away from you, period. It's negative rights against the government, not... You're assumed to have every right in the world in a free country.
Yeah, but not every... But Jason, not every amendment is a negative right.
Negative to the government. It's something they cannot take away from you, no matter what.
No, Jason, every constitutional amendment is not a statement of negative rights. There is not, for instance, the amendment that allows 18-year-olds to vote does not say, I don't think, the government shall not prohibit 18-year-olds from voting. It says 18-year-olds shall vote.
But hold it. I'm going to throw it 1 second. The minute you put the measurement 18-year-old to vote, you've had to put a measurement on that.
Let's not run into the metrics. Let's stay with policy and philosophy. So what I was getting at, for instance, because you referenced it, Jeff, consider and anybody out there, chime right in. How hard is it to get a Social Security number for a newborn infant American citizen?
It's not hard at all.
It is ridiculously simple, is it not?
No, simple as all get out. Go ahead.
Yeah. So if we are registering a newborn for universal single-payer health care, presumably it's every bit as simple.
No, I agree with you. The problem here is the economic system of which our country was founded on.
I think the deal with the Constitution is that it doesn't have to be amended for you to have a right. Yeah, I mean, you have the right to breathe air. You have the right to drink water. You have the right to walk on 2 feet if you want to. The thing is with the amendments is it's something that becomes so controversial that it has to be amended to just lay it down and say, hey, guess what? 18-year-olds can vote.
Well, why not allow 22-year-olds to vote? 10-year-olds,
I guess,
to
both
vote.
Of you are right in a sense. It may be that controversial that it has to be put in there as amendment.
Yeah, the problem is that the Constitution was deliberately made devilishly difficult to amend, and generally you only get those amendments when things have reached a state of absolute miserable crisis.
Well, are we at absolute miserable crisis or on the threshold of that now?
A lot of the American people do not think so.
Okay, go ahead.
So it's a lot easier to do it as law. Hence, for instance, what Representative Jim McDermott of Washington and Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont introduced concurrently in the Senate and the House just 2 or 3 days ago. Simply put, Medicare for all.
Hear, hear.
Well, the question then is, the right wing or the people who, well, I even don't even say the right wing, who is going to pay for it? And there you go back to the to the economic system again. Where does the money, and I mean this facetiously, where does the money come from?
It comes from us.
Okay,
just like the healthcare, single payer healthcare, in any enlightened country, comes from the taxpayers. You know, it's like the note that Scott sent in from Sweden a few nights ago, saying we are heavily taxed over here, but the difference is who's getting the money.
The reality is that it's coming from our natural resources and our labor and our intellect. That's where it's coming from. The tax structure or the way we've been... The problem is that we're caught up in the whole concept that there's the resources, the natural resources are not dispersed properly. There's plenty of natural resources to give everybody education.
Yeah, but Jeff, if we run down that rabbit hole, we're screwed.
Yeah, because next thing you know, they're calling you communist.
But are we not screwed anyway?
No, what I mean is, if we run down that rabbit hole, we are screwed for solving this immediate problem that we are talking about.
Okay. I don't think we could change within the political system the way things are going. In other words, we always repeat history. Why? Because nothing's been changed to make history change. The computers set up all new languages, and computers change history. If we continue to go the same direction we're going, we will never change history if we do nothing to try to change what a human being is worth across the board.
No. We have changed things. Women vote. 18-year-olds vote. We had a 600,000 human being death dust-up to make sure that people were no longer held in involuntary servitude. Changes have happened.
But you're in voluntary servitude now. Come on. There's people working.
No, stop. No.
They're working Burger King and McDonald's. They're trying to pay their loans off. Come on. This is not real. This is.
Jeff,
please.
Stop, Jeff.
Yeah.
It is, among other things, it is deeply insulting to say that people are in involuntary servitude when we compare that with the reality of involuntary servitude.
There's lots of poverty, isn't there?
I can't imagine that the people I know who work in other jobs, they can't make ends meet. They can't pay their student loans.
But that's not the same. That's not, Jeff, that's not the same as involuntary servitude. Involuntary servitude is slavery. Okay, and I am not going to go down this. I'm not going to go down the road on this program that, for instance, Sarah Palin went down a couple of weeks back and wound up getting Martin Bashir's pelt nailed to the wall of saying that, you know, in Sarah Palin's case, she said Obamacare is the same thing as slavery. There's nothing that is the same thing as slavery. Slavery is slavery. That's like there is nothing that is the same thing as the Holocaust. The Holocaust is the Holocaust.
I'm going to give you a true example.
You might want to insert indentured servitude there if you want to make a comparison, because that's pretty close. But slavery, no.
But Jason, with indentured servitude, people were willingly selling themselves into that situation.
Yeah, and well, I'm saying that's, well, then that makes a lot closer, of what's going on now worse in a way.
Right, it's closer, but it's not a direct analog.
Okay.
No, I didn't say.
Okay, that was splitting hairs there, man. We're basically splitting hairs. But I can tell you for a fact that a buddy of mine lost his job, and he was paying off some student loans, some other loan he had out, and he couldn't pay it, and they took him to court, and then the judge said, how much can you pay by next week? He said, I have a contract, I may get it. And all of a sudden, he didn't get the contract. He went back to court, and he didn't have the money that he promised. They put him in jail for 90 days because of contempt of court.
Yeah, debtor's prison. That's essentially what that is.
But they're not supposed to have that anymore.
Well, were those fines or were those paying somebody? I mean,
no,
you could be in prison for not paying a legal fine that the state has imposed on you. Not debtor's prison.
Jason, there are states in the union where you can be imprisoned for civil judgments against you. Alabama's one of them. I think Florida's one of them.
Hey, Bob.
So, yeah. Yeah, Jim.
Just a quick thing here. They either want your money or your time. And that's basically the axiom around which that thing rotates.
Yeah, I mean, Abraham Lincoln, Jim, said there can be no capital without labor.
Yes, he did.
And I think, you know, I think that's pretty true. Looks like we lost Jeff. Yeah, go ahead, Duncan.
Can we go back to the historical perspective of what caused the voting age to change to 18?
Absolutely. You might have some perspective on that.
I would love to comment, too.
The way I believe it, it was a result of the Vietnam War.
Right. That's exactly what it was.
Because everybody that was in, I mean, was griping and bitching, you know. They can draft us at 18, and the only thing they let us drink was near beer, I mean the 3.2 beer, but they wouldn't let us vote. I had to wait till I was 21 years old to vote.
Yeah, and we go back to the 26th Amendment right here. It's the 26th Amendment prohibits states and federal government from setting the voting age higher than 18. So it is a negative.
It is a negative, yeah.
When was that, 71 or 72?
1971, July 1st.
Yeah.
I looked it up.
That's it.
Yeah, but I was already almost... The next election, I was 21, so that was the first time I could vote anyway.
So Jason, in the scenario where you're talking about, we would need a constitutional amendment that says the federal government shall not in any wise deprive, and I'm just off the top of my head here, the government shall not in any wise deprive a human being, an American citizen, probably have to put it that way, shall not deprive any citizen of their right to health care.
Well, right now it's not the government or the states that are depriving them. It's the for-profit insurance companies.
Corporate.
So that wouldn't work. Well, you could say that... You could say that the government cannot deny, based on age, a person's access to Medicare.
Don't we already have something? I mean, isn't it if you go into a hospital, regardless of if you have insurance or not, they're required to treat you by law?
No, that's not what it says.
That nobody can refuse health care?
No, Miff, that's not what it says. It says they are required to treat you until you are stable, not until you're well.
Well, that's the operative definition right there, Bob.
Yeah, so what they do is they get you to some sort of loosely defined medical term that they call stable, and then they boot your ass out the other end of the ER.
I can tell you what it is. Either you're breathing or you're not.
Yeah. Well, he didn't die. Time to go. I mean,
You go ahead.
No. I was just going to say I've been in that circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody who listens to this program knows that I have a birth defect that causes my innards to be backwards. And that, coupled with some metabolic issues, occasionally causes my gut to flare up and become incredibly painful. I mean, unbearably painful. And the only relief... since I live in a state where everyone is presumably a junkie just waiting to blossom into full addiction, you can't go to the doctor's office and say it hurts because they can't prescribe pain relief anymore. So you have to go to the emergency room, and if you're uninsured like I am, you go to the emergency room, you run up a $15,000 bill over the course of 36 hours, and they pump you full of medications. And I don't mean, like, curative, merely palliative, till they go, does it hurt there anymore? And you go, hell, I don't know. I wouldn't know if it did. because you're so because you're so effed up. And then they say, well, we're sending you home with a prescription for a little bit more of this. And in my case, I go home and I drink water for about 6 weeks and then move up to Jell-O and then to chicken broth. The first time it happened to me, I lost 60 pounds in something like 2 months of not eating. It was essentially a water fast. But that is, you know, they didn't cure it. They didn't attempt to cure it. A surgeon looked at me and said, well, you know, we could probably solve this by getting your gallbladder out. I said, what do we got to do to that? He says, you got insurance? I said, no. He said, the cash price is about $5,000. So that's healthcare in America.
Yeah. See, I've, you know, throughout all this, you know, health insurance, healthcare, you know, I've constantly argued that, you know, there's this disconnect that's going on, that there's a difference between health insurance and health care.
Oh, absolutely.
The health care is so expensive that you can't afford it without health insurance. And if we really wanted to have true health care for every American citizen, then health insurance wouldn't exist. All those health insurance companies, goodbye, gone. Everything would be government controlled. You know, it didn't matter what doctor you went to see. It didn't matter what hospital you went to see. You wouldn't dish out any cash out of your pocket. You'd go in, get taken care of, and that'd be the end of it. I mean, that's ultimately what a lot of people are saying. That's what people say that they want. But we have this health insurance industry, and if you actually were to do something to get rid of the health insurance industry, there would be some serious economic consequences to that, because there are a lot of people employed. There's a lot of money there. And so, you know, I think that, you know, with this, you know, Affordable Health Care Act, it did some things to regulate the insurance industry, but we really needed to have, a better balance in there, where we can eventually transition to the point where we don't really need health insurance, that the cost of health care is less expensive, that people can actually afford it.
And I largely agree with you, Myth, but there, I would suggest that there is one tiny flaw in the way you laid it out. You said if we go to universal single-payer health care, all the health insurance companies go away. They don't, any more than they go away under Medicare. What they wind up being is administrators of the federal system, because we're always, I mean, the very nature of this government is such that we are always going to default and defer to the need of the so-called private sector to make a buck off of public monies. Does that sound about right, Jim?
Yes, sir, it does indeed, really. I hate to say it, but it's true.
So they would.
Yeah, I mean, that's not what I was. What I was saying is that, you know, we have these arguments about single payer system and things like that. I said, but, you know, what I'm saying is that ultimately, if every American citizen wants health care and doesn't want to have to pay for it, you know, to have the truest sense of that, you would have to get rid of health insurance. There wouldn't be any. You know, everything that has to do with health care would be completely controlled by the government. I mean, it'd be the whole, you know, communist approach, if you will. I'm not sure if that's really a good way to put it, but, you know, that's the way I look at it. I say, if you really want it, but I don't think that that's what we should do, but I'm saying that's what, if you're looking at the idea of having true health care for every single American citizen without them having to take any money out of their pockets or pay any, you know, any more additional funds, and you want inexpensive, you know, then it's got to be everything. The whole thing has to be controlled from the government from the ground up. I mean, that's the only way I could see it really truly working.
It doesn't have to be, and you can even still have for-profit. I would argue against keeping for-profit insurance companies, but you could still have insurance companies for the exotic type of care that people might want to go get, like breast implants.
Or, in the case of Michigan, non-exotic care for things like abortions for people who get raped.
Well, yeah, that's one. Yeah. And then the other thing is that what you said about if all the insurance companies go away, it's going to be a negative impact on the economy is just not true. Somebody's still going to fill those jobs. You know, they'll be paid for with taxpayer money instead of private insurance money's collecting them and skimming 20% off the top.
And right, because in a federalized system, you're still going to need people to administer it. But as is the case, for instance, with Social Security and Medicare, the administrative costs for those health care programs is wildly lower than it is for the for-profit systems, because the for-profit systems have to include in their budget, you know, the graft for the payouts for the doctors, and they have to put in the advertising costs and the Christmas bonuses for the CEO. And by the time you do that, it becomes a very, very bloated system. I think probably within the universe, I don't think that we have to haul out the word communism to talk about universal single payer health care, because there are lots of non-communist countries who are doing it. Canada comes to mind.
And doing it well.
Our buddy Scott in Sweden has given us good examples. I lived a little bit of it for a couple of weeks in Germany, where they've got a hybrid state for-profit system. But probably the most instructive, because it is, I think, the most recent in time, and any of our friends in Australia are welcome to jump in on this conversation, but Robert has been very instructive along the way, is Australia's experience. They moved to a single-payer system, I hope I'm getting this right, in the 1970s, maybe? And all along they said, hey, we're not gonna put the for-profit insurance business out. If you want for-profit insurance, God love you, go on and start writing your checks. But it works. Our colleague and dear friend John Fox can tell you how well it works. It works very well. So can Robert. So can any number of our other Australian listeners. Our buddy, the angry architect, can probably tell us. But the for-profit insurance industry didn't go out of business, and people are free to buy for-profit insurance if they want to. But anybody with a half a brain is going with the single-payer system because it is just smarter to do it. And all those people who are working in the health insurance administrative end of things are probably working. I mean, it's been a generation since, but you know, that workforce transitioned over into the administration of the national system, I would presume.
Well, it has to, otherwise it couldn't be administered.
Well, of course. Absolutely. I mean, you know, if I may jump in here, if that's okay.
Sure.
Please.
I have a good friend of mine who works as an administrator for a hospital in Columbia, South Carolina. And, of course, she and I had problems about the philosophy of that. And I told her, I said, look, I said, if I had my way, I said, all hospitals would be nationalized, and they will be paid according to a certain scale, the way federal workers are. And of course, there will be allowances for, people who are in, very sophisticated professions who would be compensated for it. But nonetheless, it would eliminate a lot of the bloat and a lot of the types of things that are paid to people who invest in HCA and all the hospital companies and things like that. And it would take a lot of the stuff off the top and put it near the bottom. And the bottom, I mean, the bottom is the care of human beings and being decent to people and try to help them through times of crisis and need.
Yeah, and you know, we talk about the employees, Jim, and I think you raise an interesting point here, in light of the fact that, look, I'm one of these people who believes in government service. I believe in the civil service. I think things like Social Security and Medicare prove the effectiveness of these programs. And frankly, I think people would probably have better jobs if they were working inside the civil service with civil service protections, wouldn't they, Jim, than
Absolutely.
If they were out there working under the tender mercies of the for-profit healthcare industry.
Absolutely, because these people who are under these tender mercies, here today, gone tomorrow. And if you have Title V protection under civil service, then you have people who are comfortable in their jobs. They're not scared of being just dismissed summarily. They have rights. They have bargaining rights. and they have the ability to not worry about all those things, those scary things, like it's Halloween every night of the year, but then they could devote their own efforts and, you know, time to the improvement of the system and the care for human beings. And I don't think the man in Galilee would disagree with that.
No, I think you'd probably get a great big amen from him. You know, amen.
Yeah, but it seems like we're going the opposite way, you know, where everything's just geared toward, I mean, even with the government workers, they're turning that into, you know, they just laid them off, during the 2 weeks plus during the sequester.
Oh, big time.
And they're, from what I understand, I don't know where I heard it, you know, it's a lot harder to quote unquote get one of those quote unquote, being sarcastic, government, cushy government jobs. And from what I understand, they're just cutting them down.
Well, and that's part of the larger issue, something that Darlene and I were talking about last night. We, as progressive people or liberal people or whatever we prefer to call ourselves, badly need to do a much better job of selling our vision, our ideas. You know, this pervasive notion that has become like some sort of gone systemic all the way into the blood infection that we got, that the private sector can always do it better, that was introduced into the body politic, yeah, pretty much by Ronald Reagan, and has festered ever since then, has got to be deconstructed at some point. You know, there was that the story from a week or so ago. We talked about it some here on the program about the NSA, and you know, it's always the NSA that's doing it, having teams of teams of spies out there lurking in World of Warcraft and Second Life chat rooms, okay? And just the moment you say it out loud, you realize how absolutely unutterably stupid that is. But you have to take the next step and say, and where did they come up with that genius idea? And you know, that it was some independent defense contractor or security contractor who said, well, you know what we really need? You know, Al-Qaeda's out there playing Second Life and World of Warcraft, and they're planning their next attack on your local Wally World and in the chat rooms there, and we need $1 billion to spy on World of Warcraft.
I better watch what I say the next time I'm in a video game, then.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I was wondering when Sergi was going to chime in on that.
But
why, thank you, Jason.
But I knew it was coming.
I played online games, too.
I can tell you where that idea comes from. I mean, it's... The simplest form of it is there is a way that you can make money, you know, actual cash off of those games. And so the idea was that, you know, Al-Qaeda and terrorist organizations and drug organizations were using that ability to launder money. And so, you know, and in the game, when you play those kind of games, you call them gold farmers. And their goal is to go out there and actually farm game currency. And then they turn around and they create a website where they will sell you that game currency. And most games, you know, tell you that they don't allow this, but it happens anyway. And that's a good way for them to launder the money. So the idea behind it was that they had actually found these – a lot of these gold farmers are from – they found them from China and from, you know, other countries. And they did find evidence that some of these people were, in fact, using – these games in this process to launder money. So that's where that idea came from.
Where it comes from are contract employees who just want to get paid to play World of Warcraft.
Yeah, well, Waggy, do me a favor. I want to make sure everybody can hear you. Can you gain up a little bit on your end?
How's that?
Yeah, that's considerably better.
All right.
Now, my dad is actually a government employee, and when he first started working for them, he was there as under a private contractor. And the government decided, and this was years ago, this was probably Reagan administration, that they actually decided that they were going to change that position to a government position, and they offered my dad the job. And it, you know, ultimately in the long run, he would actually make more money in the private sector, but he has some excellent job security. And when they sequestered them, he of course was home, but you know, he still gets, you know, in the end, he still gets all that money. He didn't lose any cash. He didn't lose any money. They're actually going to pay him for those days that he wasn't at work.
Gentlemen?
Yeah, Jim.
You know, the same thing happened to me. When I told you before how I got involved with federal government was as a private contractor, basically, just paid like that, and then, you know, was offered, you know, a transition into government service because of the reasons that this man just said. And that, and for me, that was an entire career change because it was so much better than the having to every once a year having a contract renewed. And I only did this for a year, and it wasn't for 2 years, but yeah, it was a year.
And once a year you sweat, right, Jim?
Right, absolutely, as to whether or not you have to put in a bid and this, that, and the other. And if you were underbid, you were out of a job, or if you overbid, if you were out of a job. But then when I got a call from the education officer at Fort Jackson saying, Jim, you know, this is something you might want to be interested in, because I know you don't want to teach school anymore, and I know you don't want to come in at 8 o'clock at night and teach or give tests to people till 11. It might be something you would like. And I will never forget that guy for doing it for me, R.J. Rucker. God bless him. He's long departed from us now. But he certainly helped me out a great deal in my career.
One of the things, though, is in both instances, and I'm not trying to date either you, Jim, or Myth's dad, is that was a different world. Would you agree, Jim?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because
now it's gone exactly the other way.
Right. Because how many... I honestly don't know the number, but it's huge and it's terrifying, the number of federal employees who have been cashiered as a result of the Republican desire to, in the words of Grover Norquist, make the government small enough to drown in a bathtub.
That's it. You got it. And, you know, it's, going back to contractors and things like that, 60%, this came over the TV tonight to CNN, reliable source, and there was some controversy over it between the two people who were talking. But 60% of all the Pentagon budget goes to private contractors who actually cost the taxpayer in this country at least twice as much as it would if they were in a civil service position.
Now, I want to step in here for a second on Mr. Grover there and drowning government in a bathtub.
Yeah.
A lot of this farming out of jobs is not about shrinking government. It's about increasing profits for your damn cronies, because you can farm the jobs out. The contractors cost more than the federal servants and get paid less the employees do, while the company just skims money, just...
Right. See, that remains,
it away.
Jason, that remains the great unreported story out of the whole Edward Snowden affair. There has been a lot of stunning revelations about the behavior of the NSA in his data dump, but almost all of it trails back to private contractors like Booz Allen Hamilton. And that is utterly unreported. And
have
the fact,
you ever seen the movie? I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, and the fact that all of these services could be much better provided by people who have actually sworn an oath to the government of the United States, as opposed to somebody whose only oath is to whoever it is that's signing their paycheck.
Bob Banner, I can't even talk tonight.
Yeah, jump right in, and we'll go right back to Jason.
No, but I mean, you know, basically when you are a civil service employee and you have protection, your job after tenure, and it takes 3 years to become a tenured employee, you go from career conditional, or you may go from temporary to career conditional to a career status, But that job that you have is your property under the 14th Amendment, and you cannot be deprived of it without due process of law. With a private contractor, there is no due process. There is no Title V. There are no rights that you have. All they can do is to say goodbye.
Yeah, at best, you might have a contract. At worst, you are an at-will employee, and an at-will employee is just another way of saying you have no job security at all. Jason, please jump back in.
Okay, I was going to ask, how many of you have seen the movie Iraq War for Sale?
I have.
I haven't.
I mean, if you want to look at how the contractors are just siphoning money out of our pockets, and it's our pockets because we're the taxpayers, that's a damn good movie to watch. Yeah. And it's not limited to that war. I mean, it just continues on and on and on throughout the Pentagon and throughout any other service that they can privatize.
Right.
So the laundry costs, for example, doing laundry for soldiers, providing meals. I mean,
the $29 Halliburger, sure. Whoa.
Sorry.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, Jim, too. Go ahead.
Okay, no, but I remember this. Sometimes I catch Tom Hartman, and years ago he was talking about the how, you know, not only when you have a soldier who does the cooking, you know, the mess hall, you also have a contractor doing it. You have a soldier who's also an actual fighting person and have to pay it, which is common sense.
Right, and look at the proliferation of so-called private security contractors, you know, mercenaries.
The exact movie title, I'm sorry, was Iraq for Sale, The War Profiteers, and I suggest everybody see it.
Yeah, I knew what you were talking about. Let me back up just for a second, because we actually got a little guidance in from Robert in Australia on the healthcare issue, and I had a feeling I was close to correct. Robert says, Medibank came into effect in Australia July 1st, 1975. Later it became Medicare, which it remains. It was introduced because approximately 17% of Australians at the time had absolutely no health care coverage of any sort. It's funded by a 1% levy on your income tax, now at 1.5%. Private health insurance is still available. Largely, it's seen as a queue-jumping option. Rather than wait for non-urgent surgery, people go private. Those who need urgent treatment get it straight away. There's no messing about, Robert says. Despite offering all sorts of extras, private health insurance started to fail some years back, and then Prime Minister John Howard, who was a right-winger, their Liberal Party, but it's actually conservative right-wingers, decided to reward those who took it out and punish those who didn't by increasing the Medicare levy on those without private health insurance and giving a tax break to those with it. So even when they try to game the system in favor of for-profit health care, it still doesn't work. Robert concludes, currently I receive $2,000 worth of medication each and every month, and all I pay is an $8 copay. It's not the greatest system in the world, Robert says, but it's pretty good, and I'm certainly glad it's there.
Hear, hear.
Well, it's just like with Obama when he tried to, I think originally when he, what they call, what was the Affordable Care Act, I think originally he wanted to do that, but I think he got such a negative reaction from a significant segment of the population who'd been brainwashed between the corporate media.
No. It wasn't even a significant part of the population. It was one man. It was Max Baucus.
Max Baucus.
Somebody with a lot of money.
Yeah, Max, actually, it's not that. I think that's a Latinized version of his real name. It's Max Bought. And who he was bought by was the for-profit healthcare insurance industry. You know,
he was the one vote they couldn't get to have a public option in the healthcare law.
And he's also the guy who had the people who wanted a public option arrested and hauled out of the hearing room. Yeah.
That was a sad day, Bob.
Yeah, it was.
I thought they wanted to bring up single payer.
Maybe it was.
But, but it was just the public option was all it was, and Max Baucus is a freaking Democrat.
Yeah.
No, so he says.
It's that doctor group that wants.
Yeah, it was a group of doctors. Yeah. Was it single payer that they wanted? I mean, your memory's usually pretty solid, Duncan. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They didn't even want them at the table, but I mean, public option was.
Yeah, had him, but he had him hauled out, and then he went on to kill the public option. Yeah.
Yeah.
Had a note in from Dan here. He says, I read recently that around 15% of labor working for the Pentagon is in the private sector, but it sucks up 45% of the cost of the defense budget. Now, what does that tell us?
Yeah, that's what for-profit means. You take as much as you can get.
Yeah, our defense budget, I think, could be properly said to have nothing to do with defending the national security of the United States and everything to do with defending the bank accounts of the for-profit defense industry, the military-industrial congressional complex.
Yeah, because the employees of those people sucking that money up, probably they don't make what they would as federal employees.
Well, they probably make more as private folks, based on what Jim has said and what Myth has said. They probably make more on the front end, but they make much less in the long run because of A, job security, and B, benefits. Oh, and by the way, I want to put a thank you out to Asa and to Greg. Between the two of them, we are down to only needing to raise $80 this evening. So eight more folks at $10 a piece, and we're good. We're good for the end of the week, and we enter next week not in a hole. Which reminds me, there is just a real quick, like a program note. No more and Monday, and I can already hear the oh no. So we'll carry it over into Titanic Tuesday. But Agnes and I have an appointment that we have to attend on Monday afternoon, and it's far enough away that there's no way we'll be back here in time to. For me to get behind the microphone, so my apologies.
No worries, Bob.
Doesn't it suck living out in the sticks?
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
And no.
Well, no, I mean, this isn't really the sticks. It's just a long way away from anything. I mean, there's a little dying town here, and there's a cute little town 15 miles away, but everything is centered in the larger population areas. And
yeah, I know exactly what you. That's where I grew up. Same deal.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And you know, one of the joys of living in a more rural area has lately been deeply impacted for me by virtue of the fact that come evening in cold weather, and it has. We've been here for quite a while, and I've never experienced it like this before. If you were to walk into the studio right now, once you got done screaming, you'd say, Bob, why does it smell like coal smoke in here? And that's because apparently, and I don't know I don't know if it's the cost or if it's gone cheap, or I can't imagine that it has. But like I said before, I got a bunch of neighbors burning that filth around me, and I can't keep it out of my house.
God, Bob, what if you lived in China? Have you seen the reports on?
Oh, Jesus,
place?
Shanghai, where you can't see a foot in front of your face.
I mean, and when you see scenes of the population on the street. It's like they're going into an operating room.
Doesn't anybody use wood stoves?
For a long time people did. And I hate to say that there's plenty of any resource, but wood is not hard to come by around here. But for some reason or other, I've got a bunch of neighbors who have decided that their solution is to burn coal. And I tell you what, there's one of those
things. And naturally the exhaust doesn't go into their house.
Oh, no. No, it comes out of their chimney and blows into mine.
Yeah, blows in the other direction.
My God, how far are we from the London of Charles Dickens?
I think they're living it in China, Jim.
Oh, no, they are. I mean, my God, I couldn't believe what I saw on TV today and the air pollution levels and pulmonary diseases, cancer, stuff like that. It was just It's really horrible. I mean, I don't know how that country's going to continue
and
if they don't do something about it, and I think they already are.
And based on the sort of natural transition we seem to have just made, I've got a story that I've been sitting on here for a couple of days now. Comes out of the L.A. Times. Now, we know, so everybody's seen the pictures of Shanghai, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. So couple that with this headline. Again, the L.A. Times from 3 days ago. EPA plans to sharply reduce inspections, saying it wants to focus on the biggest polluters. The EPA proposes to cut federal inspections by one-third and reduce civil enforcement cases 23%.
It sounds like George Watt and Ronald Reagan are back in charge of the EPA or whatever, the environment,
So basically what they're saying is, this is their justification from Alicia Johnson, an EPA spokeswoman. She says, from our work on the biggest enforcement cases, such as the BP Deepwater Horizon spill, and we know how well that went, to aggressively pursuing smaller cases that can reduce harmful health impacts and have the greatest environmental benefit, our enforcement work will continue to save lives and protect our environment. To which I holler bullshit, okay? Because if they were saving lives, we wouldn't be having statistical excess deaths in southern West Virginia that we have.
Yeah, and who knows what's going to end up in Louisiana in 5, 10, 15 years down the road. I mean, especially down on a golf course, but Gulf Coast, not just Louisiana with the oil spill, who knows what they did. Because I heard they put chemicals on it to basically sink it and hide the oil.
Yeah, corrects it. Hey, but not only that, Jim, but just wait till that Keystone XL pipeline makes its way down there and they start refining that shit upwind of you.
Praise Bob, yeah.
Yeah, no kidding. Hey, I got another blinking light here I want to bring onto the air. Hey, who have I got?
Hello, Bob, is that you?
Yeah, hey, Jeff.
I'm sorry, my phone went dead in the middle of that discussion.
Yeah, it's not the first time that somebody's had a phone die in the middle of the program, so don't worry about it.
Anyway, I really love the work you guys are doing, and I just wish that we can move to realize that I don't believe you can legislate any changes. I think we're just spinning our wheels, and I think we have to really get away from what we're doing and think something different to change it, because it's been going on like this for that I could see 50 years in my lifetime, and it was we had a great life. When you mentioned to someone earlier that times have changed, I know that years ago I worked a 40-hour work week and I supported a family of four comfortable and put them through school, and those days are gone. And all the nonsense we're agreeing with, we all agree with it, but not I don't see anyone. And I think you believe that there can be solutions politically. And I don't believe, I think that the political game is a shell game and it doesn't really matter which side. I agree with you. The perception is that the Democrats are better than the Republicans. But I only see two or three good politicians out there, and one of them is Kucinich when he's gone, and Bernie Sanders and a few others. But basically, it's perception, and I don't think we're going to be able to change anything unless we start thinking, I hate to use the word outside the box, but outside the political system, it's not going to happen.
And yet in a polity, I don't know how you accomplish anything without the system when the system is all you have. I mean, obviously, the story from Australia is proof positive. What Robert just described about their experience getting everybody insured in the country, it can be done. But what we have is a hopelessly, utterly, absolutely dysfunctional political reality right now. And the larger question then is, can it be fixed, or is it inexorably broken?
I concur. I think that the world economic system, I don't care. I'm sure Australia, even New Zealand, every country I know of is being affected by this economic system. They're all over the world, you're seeing people who are saying, we can't, we, this is, something's wrong all around the world. It's not just here. It's all over the world. What I'm saying is that there's something systemically broken with the economic system. It has nothing to do with the countries. I think that you can fix the system, but you can fix the system without a different means of thinking. And I think the means of thinking is a very simple way of getting basic inalienable rights in and making a 4-hour or 5-hour work week.
But Jeff, if your thesis is correct, then how is it that we managed to get these dispatches from our buddy Scott in Sweden, who explains to us how they do make it work there?
In some cases, and by the way, it used to work better. Now it still works, but it doesn't work as well. They have less vacation time than they had before. Their healthcare system is still good, but it's not as good as it used to be. The vacation time in Europe used to be a hell of a lot more. It worked better for the population than it does now. I mean,
it's still 6 weeks.
Well, it's still not as good as it was a while back. It is still 6 weeks. But the point I'm making is that I was talking to a fellow from Sweden who does the resource-based economy, and he was from Sweden, and we both agreed that, well, he explained to me that it wasn't as good as it used to be. And what I'm saying is that we need to be able to think. First of all, we have to think globally. You cannot no longer think that this is a systemic U.S. problem. It's a worldwide economic problem. And my suggestion is very simple: a basic quality of life, which is education, shelter for everybody across the board for 20 or 30 hours a week minimum. I mean, that's the maximum. It's the most you should have to work unless you choose to work longer.
Well, gentlemen, let me ask you something.
Go ahead, Jim.
How can that possibly be? First, nothing is as good as it used to be. In China, people are working 60 and 70 hours a week, which was more than Germany was working under wartime conditions. I mean, you know, it's just the way things have gone.
Well, hell, they're working hard. I mean, the ones who survived are working harder now than they worked under Mao.
And, you know, I'll tell you something. Yes, as far as this country is concerned, and I will never forget this quotation from one of my favorite authors, Gore Vidal. He said, in this country, there is only one party. It is the property party. One of them is Republican. The other is Democrat.
Yeah,
but I just believe that we have to work inside the system where we can and outside the system all the time. And as far as going completely global, I totally disagree. I think we should isolate ourselves as much as possible. We should go back to protectionism. And then every other country can figure that out on their own as well.
Unfortunately, world politics don't permit that now.
Well, that's where you have to work inside the system to change the politics.
Well, by what?
And you push them from the outside. You have to push them from the outside.
May I ask, by what mechanism would you enforce that policy?
Well, there's plenty of mechanisms out there. So there's all kind of groups that you can join, activist groups. And
don't tell me.
And there's also this single fact that you could just show up inside your party.
Listen, don't give me these literal generalities. Give me concrete specifics. Give me one mechanism that would accomplish at least a portion of that goal. Please.
Publicly financed elections.
Oh, hold it. You're
publicly financed elections?
Publicly financed elections.
You're back to the finances again. How do you control the finances?
With law.
Then you've got to make a law.
Law.
You gotta overturn what the Supreme Court's done for a long time coming.
You just chased
and
your
have
tail,
publicly
man.
Financed elections. Basically, every candidate gets the same amount of money. You go out there and you run on what your beliefs are instead of running out there and running on how much money you can raise.
Yeah, who's going to enforce that? It'd be a case of Fedlex, Duralex, the law is latex.
About the
the idea
Kathy,
behind
wait, hold on. Kathy hasn't said much
I'm not
at all.
Telling you how to...
Wait, Jason.
I'm sorry. I'm out.
Kathy, jump in.
Thank you. You know, I think, I don't know names yet, but whoever said about the Supreme Court, that's where it starts. It starts there. I mean, obviously, we have to gain, quote-unquote, control of the Supreme Court. I mean, look what we've lost under the Supreme Court. So many things. So that's so important, number one. And number two, I think it's local, and it's honestly, it's so sad to say, it's going to be pain that causes people to change. Pain, and I think the ACA is going to cause people to change. I really do. I think that once people who have not supported, quote unquote, the progressives or whomever, whatever label you want to do call, and are maybe Southern Republicans, that will change their mind and see what government can do for people. And about the EPA and the losses of what provided regulation, that's, you know, part of drowning government in the bathtub. That's what the Republicans wanted to do, is get rid of the EPA. So that's not surprising. I mean, the goal is in the vote. I know it's going to be a struggle. It's going to be a huge struggle, but you've got to vote.
Well, I think it's a matter of, you, if you don't listen, you have to feel, and I don't mean feel too good, but to galvanize people into realizing, hey, this isn't working, and, you know, we need to do something about this. And it's going to take a painful journey into that realm of decency.
It's like something that I pointed out a good while back. If you look with an unbiased eye at the times in American history when significant social change has taken place, they are windows of about 2.5 years. And what you have to have is a president dynamic enough to lead a majority that he has in the Congress to affect legislative change. And he also has to be of sufficient understanding of the dynamics of the legal system to appoint the right people to the Supreme Court. There's a really good object lesson in Abraham Lincoln.
That's right.
Wait, please. Prior to the Civil War, the Congress had tried to introduce legislation that created the land-grant universities and colleges that we recognize to this day. My alma mater, West Virginia University, is a land-grant institution.
Clemson University in South Carolina is a good one.
Is a land-grant institution, absolutely. And they could not get it passed because the recalcitrant Southern contingent refused to have any part of it because they had an economic philosophy that is roughly equivalent to the economic philosophy of the godforsaken teabaggers today. Now, what happens? The Civil War comes. 1862, the land-grant legislation that created the land-grant universities is passed because there was a majority in the Congress, absent the Southerners, that was willing to pass the legislation. It was largely the same people that wanted to pass it in the first place, but the Southerners were out of the way. Now, on the other side of that equation, where you've got to have a president who understands the import of whom he appoints to the Supreme Court, Abraham Lincoln had a thorn in his side for the entirety of his presidency by the name of Salmon P. Chase.
Oh, boy, he sure did.
Chase was brilliant because Chase, by virtue of his, on the one hand, he was a religious zealot, but he also had a real fascination for money. And as a consequence, he made nicey with the banker boys up east and in Chicago and got them to buy up the war bonds that the United States sold in order to finance the Civil War. And that's that moment in American history when we understand the value of debt. Okay, now wait. So the problem, though, that was the good part of Salmon P. Chase. The bad part of Sam and P. Chase is that he never had a single second inside the Lincoln administration when he wasn't scheming somehow to be the Republican presidential nominee in 1864 because he felt anointed by God and felt like something had just gone wrong, maybe Satan or something, insofar as he did not get elected president in 1860. So, when, after a great long period of time, that horrible, horrible, horrible man, Roger Taney, who gave us the Dred Scott decision, finally went to his long home and breathed out and didn't breathe in again, Lincoln, seeing an opportunity, a political, not a social or economic or governmental opportunity, but a political opportunity, immediately appointed Salmon P. Chase, who had been his treasurer, to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States so as to get him the F out of his, Lincoln's, hair. And out of that, the Salmon P. Chase Court goes on to hand us some of the decisions that wind up giving us what Mark Twain derisively referred to as the Gilded Age.
Oh, boy, it was gilded for a few people.
But it was a big deal with Lincoln, and what happened, from what I gathered, well, from what I can understand, when we tried to borrow money to have the Civil War, and he couldn't afford the interest rate, so that's when he come up with the greenback dollar with zero interest. And that dollar worked great. So this is how Lincoln, as far as I saw, how he was able to do that, how this country flourished, not because of the war, but because we had a zero interest currency that we traded on without interest.
We never could have the Union never could have survived the Civil War without the debt.
Oh,
and the war
absolutely
bonds.
Absolutely not. That's what they had to do to provide the greenback dollar. Wasn't
that where the greenback dollar came about?
The greenback dollar also comes in during the Civil War, but it is not the reason that the United States was able to prosecute the war. The United States was able to prosecute the war against the treasonous South because it engaged in debt, significant debt, big debt. And oddly enough, if you wander around, and I know you have, Jeff, and I know you have too, Jim, and maybe some others, if you wander around on Capitol Hill, there are all those magnificent old townhomes up on Capitol Hill, on beyond the Capitol, beyond the Supreme Court. They're beautiful.
And they were permanent residences for these people.
They were, and they were constructed along about, you know, between, you know, the real blossoming began about 1880, and it went wild till about 1910.
That's right.
And it was all made possible by virtue of the fact that the United States had been willing to go into debt. It was government spending that fostered all of that private enterprise. The same thing can be said of the spending programs of FDR's administration, which is another one of those moments in American history where you have a little tiny window that opens for about 2.5 years and then slams shut. And we do not have that, and we have not had that opening in a very, very long time.
Jim,
you haven't spoken in a while. Go ahead.
Okay. It seems like I remember when Obama got in, not that he was going to be the answer all, but it seemed like he was trying to do some things, but he couldn't, similar, you know, like a FDR kind of like the WPA program, or you know what I mean, a works program to help, you know, get people working, but he didn't have the votes to do it, and even then, even the mention of FDR seems to
there were significant differences, Jim, and at least as I see them, insofar as one, the Democratic majority that Barack Obama had upon his ascension in January of 2009 in the House of Representatives was a Democratic majority in name only, because a great number of those Democrats were the so-called blue dogs that we understand now to have been little more than Republican light. And that is why in 2010 they got turned out on their ear, because why would some conservative right-wing teabag and jackass voter in Alabama or Mississippi vote for Republican light when he's got a sure enough crazier than a bedbug Republican that he can vote for? And people like Rahm Emanuel, who had masterminded that garbage, got taught a brutal lesson in electoral politics out of it. That's how we wind up with the Republican majority we have today and the teabagger triumph of 2012 and all of that foolishness. Because Barack Obama did not have a real Democratic majority with which to work in the House, and he himself is not, was not, and never has been anything that you and I would, and Dr. Bill said as much on Wednesday, that you or I would recognize as a liberal or a progressive or an FDR style or even a JFK style Democrat. He's a University of Chicago center rightist. Always has been and always will be.
And look
what happened to Howard Dean.
Okay, hold it. Let's go with that. How would you go ahead? Let's go with that. I'm agreeing with you. But how do we go from where we are now to where we're going to elect somebody who's going to benefit the general population of this country or this world? Tell me how you propose to do that.
Well,
before you can benefit the population of this world, you must lead by example and benefit what's on your own borders, hypocritical about it.
Okay, Jim, how do we go ahead? If Obama got into office on the concept of change, and we had a bunch of right wing Democrats, just for lack of anything better to say,
Democrats in name only.
And we got sold down the tubes. How do you propose to change this ever?
Okay, can I take a run at that?
You're there.
Yeah, okay. First of all, it is going to change, Jeff. And it is going to change probably in the next less than 50 years. It will change because of the demographic change in America. Some of what you see out of the teabaggers and the various and sundry booger eaters out there, the wild-eyed reactions that they have, is a direct result of the fact that, I mean, these are the howls of a dinosaur that's wandered into a tar pit. They know they're going down, and they're going to go down screaming, okay? It is going to change. Now, secondly, I would like to think that we are all in this conversation out of our political pampers, and we know that change was a godforsaken election slogan and not a theory of governance.
Go ahead. You're on a roll. Go.
Now, if you want to talk about beginning to implement things that matter to progressives, well, you know, rule one is something that was taught to me by a very, very wise dear friend of mine up in Wisconsin, who said, "The ears do not hear until the belly rumbles."
In other words, if you don't listen, you have to feel.
Well, yeah, or you're not going to listen until you've got some sort of vested interest in listening, Jim.
That's what I'm saying.
Hey,
go,
Bob.
Yeah.
Could I ask Roger, who I just brought into this conversation, are you still active in the California Democratic Party?
Yes, I am. Did you hear me?
Yeah,
yes, I am. We can hear you.
Okay.
So, do you have anything to add to the conversation?
Not right now. I've been kind of away from media for a while, and so I'm kind of lurking right now. But one of the problems is, even if you're active in the party, when you go to the convention, there's a small cadre of people that have a lock on stuff. And Larry can probably tell you this, too, me, Gimp, that it's really hard to get anything done even when you're active.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah,
you're
gatekeeping, right. Sure. And the question is, how do we build a structure that can overcome the gatekeeping?
Key, go ahead.
The right wing is far better at this stuff than are we.
Why is that, Bob?
Because they have unlimited amounts of money from people like the Koch brothers to fund bullshit organizations like Americans for Prosperity.
Funny because of the economic system that is.
No! Stop! We're not running down that rabbit hole. I'm not trying to gatekeep in my own right, but we're not going to run down that rabbit hole. Because if we start talking about trying to fix the global economy, economic situation before we ever that's rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic while the water's rushing into the hull.
Well, I think it's the opposite, but go ahead.
I heard, and maybe he's not the best reference for this group, but I heard Van Jones say something very, very important once upon a time. He said I find it interesting and funny. The right wing talks about how there are all these rugged individualists, but they will get together and march in the streets in collective groups and get shit done. On the other hand, progressives talk about how we all believe in the collective, but we can't get together and agree what time to have lunch.
You know, it's interesting because there's a certain amount of individualism that I think is very, very important, and I think that's what makes everything happen. But it has to be balanced with a certain amount of, there is a certain amount of collectivism has to work the same way socialism has to work with capitalism. There's a certain balance there that we have not yet hit, and it has to be done, and I believe on a worldwide basis. But I think you have to focus on where the flames are coming from. If you want to make the reference with the Titanic as the ship's going down, arrange the chairs, I'd say fine. If that's what you want to do, as long as you think you're benefiting someone, that's great. I want to still see if I can patch the hole in the Titanic. Do you see where I'm going with that?
Yeah, well, I mean, to work another analogy, you don't worry about the patient having a broken toe when the patient also has a sucking chest wound. Okay,
well,
and the United States is in sucking chest wound territory right now.
I want to know is where the chest wound came from. That is where I'm coming from. We need to find out why we keep on getting the chest wound.
Can I answer the sucking chest wound question in three words?
Go ahead.
Ronald Wilson Reagan.
That was the beginning. You're right. I agree with you. I was beginning
in
reference.
The first thing that godforsaken freak, who I hope is barbecuing on a spit up his ass in hell, did was to take the solar panels off the White House roof. The second thing he did was to tax the tips of waitresses. Then he got around to firing the air traffic controllers.
Yeah, I was there when he did that. I mean, I was a union rep then. And he also told the people that the ketchup is the kid's vegetable. Oh, I'm sorry. Look, you're going to fire me up. I'm trying not to get fired up. You there?
No.
Yeah.
No, I agree with you. Ronald Reagan was a downfall. That's when I said 40 years ago. And the only
Let's
thing
not forget how he even got into office.
California's gift to the country.
Well, he could read a speech well.
I thought it had something to do with abandoning our troops until he was elected.
No, I'll tell you how he got into office. He got into office by treason.
Yeah, you mean
that had to do with Iran, the Iran hostages.
Yeah, you mean cutting a deal with the mullahs to make sure that Carter didn't get the hostages freed before the election, and then promising them that in return for them releasing the hostages, we would sell them some missiles for use in their war against Iraq.
Wasn't that meeting held in the Mayflower Hotel?
It was indeed.
Aircraft, because they had a lot of U.S. aircraft at the time, and they needed parts for their aircraft and for all their military stuff.
I just want to bring something to that. If we continue to do this for still limited hangouts, but I'm trying to say that I listened to Howard Zinn the other night I love Zinn. And I listened to one of his recordings, and he says very simply, he says, we can keep on doing what we're doing, and we're not doing that much. But if we can do something that actually, if we can do something that matters, we most probably will be able to change history. We have to figure out a way to change the way the system is working now. And I'm not telling you I know what to do, but I just know we need to stop chasing our tails and thinking that the Supreme Court is going to work. It's not going to work any longer. We have to stop electing people who... there's no way we can change the way the election process is working if the economic system continues to bring the same people aboard. I don't know how to change this, but I do know it's a definite problem with the economic system, be it in this country or worldwide. Yeah. It's a problem with our economic system. And gentlemen, you got to, and ladies, you must figure, as a matter of fact, I think my wife, she figured out this better than I did, but it's very, very important to change the way the economic system in this country is working. And I don't think you can do it within the confines of these laws that we, that the people who are making them now work.
The larger economic system, Jeff, will only change in this country upon its collapse.
Collapse. Yep.
Which is going to happen. The capitalists are insuring it. So I'm not too worried about that.
It's supposed to happen, and when it happens, then the people with the money, or the bitcoins, or the gold, buys up all the other real value, and then the poor people get poorer. It goes on.
I don't think they're going to get away with it too much longer.
How are you going to stop them? With a gun? You sound like a right winger. No, it can't work.
No nastiness.
I didn't bring that up.
No. I'm not calling you down. I'm calling Jeff down. Don't call anybody a right winger in here because they're not allowed.
No, you can't possibly do it. When the system collapses, it has to have something to fill the void. It's just going to be the people with the money again taking more and more and more. Psychopathic behavior. You need to be able to do this in a sane manner without using force or guns. You've got to be able to think this thing through, and there is, in my opinion, there is a way of doing it. I just wish I was smarter to figure it out. And I wish people would, you know, well, you guys have good minds. You need to now figure out what is wrong with the system. Step back from the problem and say, this is the basic essence of the problem is the economic system. And then we have to say, what can we do to remedy that? And this has not happened since the Constitution was written. It's happened well before Britain was even established. So we need to look at this carefully.
Well, don't beat yourself up, Jeff, because far more brilliant minds than are in this room have been deviled by this question for a long time. The last person to posit a halfway decent answer to the question did it in what? 1840? 1848? His name was Marx. He had a buddy named Engels.
God, I was just about to say Karl Marx already told you. Capitalism is going to devour itself. All we got to do is sit back and watch.
Okay. Marx was great, but if you want to watch something great, watch Marx Comes to Marx in the Soho. Marx in Soho. It's a great play that Howard Zinn wrote. And but the only thing Marx didn't have, he had the right concept, but he didn't have the measurement. Never mind. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
In the modern era, I'm just thinking historically here, and history is my weak subject, so perhaps Mr. Kincaid can take it back a little bit further. But I'm thinking that the only way that entire countries have changed their economic, political, and social systems were under ruthless dictators.
Exactly.
Stalin, Mao, Hitler, Franco, Mussolini.
That's why Marx predicates the dictatorship of the proletariat.
I mean, excuse me, gentlemen, but I mean, you were talking about people who had unusual solutions. We've had numerous examples of people with unusual solutions when the other more democratic systems that seem to claw at each other like two cats over a clothesline did not work. And that's exactly how Adolf Hitler came to power. Adolf Hitler came to power in a Germany in which there were 32 parties. And what did he do?
The fact of the matter is they were starving to death also.
Stalin, good Lord in heaven, he was worse than Hitler as far as that was concerned. Socialism in one country was Stalin's thing because, Trotsky wanted to spread worldwide revolution. And that was where Stalin and Trotsky had their real problem. And that's when Trotsky ended up with a pickaxe in his head when he was in Mexico. Because Stalin sent somebody to eliminate the Fourth International, but basically it was worldwide revolution, building castles of air, with Stalin, socialism in one country, building socialism in his own guise concretely.
Can I ask a question?
But the bottom line is it's an individual that does it.
Exactly. Can I ask you a question?
Single person.
I want to ask you all a question. Maybe you can answer that.
Could I interrupt for a minute?
Duncan, yes, please.
I just brought Thomas Jug into the Skype group.
I just saw that. Yeah.
You want a bill update?
Yeah, I was going to ask for that very thing.
Oh, yeah, that's important.
Is my headphone on?
Yeah, you're great, Thomas.
I wasn't sure where it was muted or not. Well, basically, I don't know what, you know, it's getting the end of the day. He's getting pretty tired, and so I tried to hook him up to the phone, but, you know, it just wasn't working. He just wasn't responding as natural as he probably would in the past. So, you know, I'll just have, day by day, he's hoping, telling him he might get out of there Monday, but, you know, it might be just keeping his hopes up and all that, but, you know, not being able to see his medical records or anything. Don't know.
Well,
he wasn't as lucid as I wanted. His short-term memory, as you observed, it didn't seem to be there.
But, you know, a lot of these things, Thomas, you know, things happen in a stroke kind of situation, and they come back over time. The brain kind of rewires itself.
Yeah, I'm thinking about nerve damage I've had, and all of a sudden my arm was paralyzed, and then one day I woke up and it was working again. How does that happen? I don't know.
I say that's a miracle, and you're very, very fortunate.
Yeah, but the short-term memory loss could be permanent. My mom suffered from that. All she'd ever converse about would be old stories.
Whoops.
Right. That's the typical pattern of that thing. I mean, they can't remember yesterday, but they can remember 15, 20, 30 years ago.
Oh, my mom remembered what she was doing as a kid growing up on the ranch. But she couldn't tell you what she watched on TV last night.
Oh, God, that's so sad when that happens to people. I mean, you know, I know that may sound like trifles, sentimentalism or whatever, but it's just dreadful when that happens to people.
That's very scary.
And then they get stories embedded in their brains, and they'll tell them over and over again. And you will get sick of them.
Well, you know, that's
my mind.
You know, everything she came into this world and had a brain being functioning, everything is there. It's all there. It's never lost. It's all encoded in that computer that we call a brain. It's always there. And, of course, the fortunate or the unfortunate, excuse me, well, that's fortunate that we have such memory capacity. But, unfortunately, the access becomes denied by, you know, cerebral and other types of vascular displacement or malfunction, in which those areas are denied, you know, and that's basically what happens, I think.
Well,
Thomas, are you still on?
Yeah, I just unmuted.
Okay. I just wanted to say, tell Bill that we're all pulling for him and we all love him.
Yeah, I will do that. I read Jay Cruzan's letter to him, his poem.
Hey, Thomas, does he remember you? He remembers you pretty well, right?
Correct.
Let's just go ahead and, with all this other stuff, let's just forget about it. Bill's going to make a full recovery. He may lose half a day or a few days or whatever.
I'm just down the road. We'll see what happens. You know, it's money get him moved out. Again, his computer equipment. I'm planning on going up to the his current place of living, see about getting access, see if I can, see what the state of his packing and that and computer equipment, see if I get access.
Hey, Thomas, they're so limited in what they can and will say to you, but I was told when I talked to the duty nurse or charge nurse at station, that social services there are on the job, and that they are working on the move issue.
Yeah, correct. And they mentioned some person's name that says a friend of Bill's talking to the social worker, is looking in hand, trying to contact and take care of the move for him. But the name that they mentioned didn't ring a bell with me, and I didn't get a response from Bill about that name.
Yeah, but this much is obvious. He didn't have a problem recognizing you, and I can say for a fact that even
Correct.
Though it was a telephone call, he had no problem knowing it was me.
Good.
But it did. He seemed a bit confused about where he was or why he was there.
Yeah, and the time in between is what you have to worry about. But the time in the future, I mean. I don't think anybody should speculate on worst case scenarios or talk about.
No. This is just about the immediate future, Jason.
Yeah, I know, but I just keep hearing us talk about people with brain dysfunction and stuff. I don't even want to talk about that because I just don't think it's going to happen.
Well, it's reality, though. It happens.
But we don't know, Jim.
But you know, have they discussed anything with it's too early, I guess. Transfer to a type of living facility in which he has care.
Not with me, HIPAA again.
Yeah, that's the thing. We can't get any information until such time as he is to himself enough to meaningfully understand what he's doing. If he signs a release allowing them to talk about his situation with Thomas.
Well, Bob, is there any family there that he...
No, I mean, he's noted repeatedly that he's got no family.
Okay. I didn't know.
I was talking some with Agnes about that. You know, that's one of those worst-case scenario nightmares because, you know, patient advocacy, and I don't care if you're in to have your ingrown toenail taken care of. One of the things that we recognize in the modern study of, or has we, like I've been studying it, one thing that is recognized in the modern study of healthcare delivery is that people have dramatically better outcomes when, for instance, they go to the doctor and someone sits in the appointment with them.
Oh, yeah. So they can report what's being said.
I tried to get contact information to get a hold of Mr. Stress, and I was advised that I should just let him rest and that he's probably got family around him. But so I don't know how to handle that. That was from Greg. Greg suggested that I hang back.
Well, my experience is with my mother, because I had to bring her home from the hospital several times. The social workers would contact you right after, during the discharge operation, and then all the home health care workers and stuff would start piling on. But the social worker is probably looking for somebody to take care of him or find a way, a friend or somebody to.
Yeah.
So, Maybe Jug could find out who the social worker is and talk to them.
Yeah, I'm not trying to lay down rules or anything like that. But in situations like this, you want people reaching out with whom he is actively, frequently familiar.
I understand.
You know, somebody like Thomas. Isaac talks to him quite frequently. Kevin has established a relationship with him. He and I have obviously talked a lot so that we don't exacerbate any confusion that may already be a function of whatever it was that happened. Does that make sense to you, Thomas?
Thomas?
I'm muted. Yes, number one, you don't need to overwhelm that staff with Hunter Horney's calling in, and they know who I am. They know my wife is an RN. We've both been up there. They met us, and they've seen us. You know, actually tonight, the nurse was very grateful that I did come up to see Bill, and you know, I don't want to overwhelm that staff and have them get a soured attitude towards us.
Right, and I have repeatedly now, because I've talked to different charge nurses or duty nurses, or I don't even know what the right term is. The nurse that answers the phone, I've told her who I am, why I'm calling, how I know Bill, how Bill knows me, and how many people out there are absolutely rooting for him. And I told him that personally again today. So, you know, okay. He knows. He absolutely, and he recognized that. And he talked about wanting to be in on tonight's conversation. I was kind of guessing it would wind up being the way that Thomas found it to be, because it's hard to be in a hospital and in any circumstance. So, you know, I'm hoping maybe things they'll come up with some sort of a diagnosis, and some, you know, one of the things, frankly, that I found out is that, did they talk to you about this, Thomas? There is a rehab plan out there. They're trying to do rehab with him.
Correct, and it's written on his sideboard.
But that he is, and it's probably a function of what has happened of late, he has been less than cooperative.
Uh-huh. Well, that means he's himself.
Cooperative, yeah, he was getting a little belligerent, and I said, no, Bill, it's for your good. He'll stay here till Monday. Now, don't fight it and work with him. And he right. said to me, I will.
Jug, not that he's, you know, he's still with us, but does he have a power of attorney or some?
No, that's the problem, Larry. He doesn't have any of that.
No, and the problem is, you know, I could get a nice little, all nice legal form to have him sign it and be worth, paper at the bottom of a birdcage.
Okay.
Yeah, well, because he doesn't have the capacity to sign it right now.
Okay, I understand. Okay.
Yeah, it's going to take some time. Give him a few days, and then he'll be ruled competent, and he'll be all right. They'll let him go, and he'll be on his way. Probably just like a little mini stroke is all.
Well, no, thanks for being positive. Yeah,
well, that's me. I'm sorry, but that's just me.
Okay.
Positive.
You got to have, you know, all that stuff notarized too. I have power of.
Yeah, and the notary will not notarize if the notary has any question about the validity of the execution of the document.
That's
and the our family trust documents were made up by a lawyer in 1998. So,
right,
I'm having a headache with the bank right now just getting my mother's name removed from the account because they didn't have the successor documentation to the trust.
And one of the things that, and I want to make it abundantly clear, I don't feel good about talking about someone who isn't there, but this is by way, I hope, of informing everyone. I mean, I'm getting more emails now than I ordinarily do of people just wanting to know that Bill's okay. And so consequently, the purpose of this discussion is to provide as much information as we possibly can.
Yeah, that's right. And also, don't forget, next week when he's feeling all better, he's going to listen to this on a podcast, too.
Yeah. Exactly. Although truth be told, Bill was a big one for listening live. As soon as Thomas gets his computer fired back up, and as soon as the clock hits 6 o'clock Eastern, he'll be right back here.
And I'll delete all links to the podcast so he can't go find them.
Well, you know what? I think that's kind of and I don't mean this derogatorily or negatively. When I talked to him, he still didn't know exactly what had happened on the air with us.
And I
would never want him to feel any kind of embarrassment. He tried to apologize to me, and I told him that would not be tolerated and was not necessary. But I don't think it would be a good idea for him to hear that event.
Yeah, and I wasn't planning on ever playing it for him. I don't think it would do him any good.
I think dignity is very important in this situation.
Well, and it's one of the operating philosophies behind this entire community, Jim, and I think you're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this is the other Jim, and I missed a couple of your shows, Bob, and from what I can just piece together, I heard something happened to Bob, and I hope everything, Mr. Stress, and I wish the best for him. I hope everything works out. So I'm putting my good vibes out there.
I appreciate it. And a lot of those have been coming in. Just got a note in from Darlene, whom we talked to last night, saying well wishes for Bill. Please pass on my good wishes to him. I think of him every day and hope for his speedy recovery, as do we all. Mm-hmm. We are at about... go ahead, Kathy.
I was just going to say, we should be happy that he's resting because sleep is so restorative. And in this case, it's really restorative. So, you know, when he rests and can rest a lot, that helps him.
Absolutely. It's one of the best things I read somewhere, and this may seem ancillary, but I think there's validity to it. I read somewhere that cats, and Jim, maybe you know this,
yes,
cats,
sir.
When they're purring, you know, we as humans respond really positively to cats purring.
Yes, we do.
But when a cat is purring, it's actually building bone matter.
It is. And it can mean several things. It can mean good things or bad things.
But in order to do that, it has to be in some sort of restful state. So I think there's probably something in the human physiology like that, too. So the more Bill rests, the more he sleeps, the more he is not sitting around worrying about the move. And like I said, you know, if I was in the business of imploring lightning bolt-wielding deities to fling a couple, we could start with the management of that place where he was living, because I'm truly pissed off about that.
I think that's the first thing you love it, Bob. It really did, because he was okay. And then he mentioned a couple weeks ago or a month or so ago what had happened to him and why he tried to, you know, logically deal with the situation. And then, of course, there was the underlying problems with the management and the people who really, in my opinion, precipitated this crisis within this man's mind. Because, as I said to you earlier, there's only so much a human being at a certain age can stand. And until, you know, something very...
And because of the way my mind works, one of the first things I thought was, well, gosh, if they're treating Bill this way, you got to wonder how they're treating the other people in that building.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you got it.
Just like they treat the workers. It's not that different, you know, from the micro to the macro.
Yeah, exactly. But it is 7 minutes before the hour. Just a reminder, as you have every Friday night for lo these many years, Duncan, you will be hosting the Horn Malloy Skype chat group somewhere around about 12:05 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, correct?
Correct, and after this, you sign off. We still stay live.
Oh, that's true.
We go all night now.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Well, I thank all of you. It's been a really good room this evening. Thanks to the folks who have contributed on the traditional telephone lines, and thanks to everybody in the Horn Malloy Skype chat group. Thank you first and foremost, Duncan, for being the long-suffering and patient host of it, and playing referee as well as you do. Thanks to Kathy, Jason. It's always nice to see you, Sergi. You've been a little bit quiet, but we know you're there. Good to hear from you, Larry. Mm-hmm. Nice to see you wander in, Betsy. Thomas, thank you so much for what you're doing for Bill and for updating us. Roger, it's awful nice to see you. Myth, good to hear from you. Waggy, thank you. Always good to hear from you. And Todd, you're there. Did you ever get it working, Todd?
Well, intermittent. Yes.
Okay.
Losing internet connections, or my connections to the router. seems like about every 5 minutes, so yeah, I caught bits and snippets.
You know what? You will get ever so much better at it the more familiar you become with the process. So thanks, all of you. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Jim. Thanks, Jeff, for your contributions this evening. To anybody who didn't get in, I apologize. But thanks, thanks all of you very much. Have good a good weekend. And again, just a gentle reminder, no more on Monday because Agnes and I have to be at an appointment that will take. I won't be able to get back up the mountain in time to get behind the mic. So my apologies for that. But back at it on Tuesday. And thank you all very much. And like I said, have a good weekend.
Thank you, Bob.
Have a good weekend.
Thank you. And so that brings us to the close of a rousing good Friday on the front porch. It's about 5 minutes before the hour, and I will close out by noting that we end the evening $75 short on fundraising. If that can happen and you can help make it happen, it is certainly appreciated because, well, darn it, we'll get ourselves in a hole on Monday. It can't be avoided. There's no way. But thank you. Thank you very much for everything that keeps all of this going. Thanks, of course, to our all-volunteer staff. I've already mentioned Duncan, otherwise known as Sparky. Thanks also to Lottie and Texas Betsy. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox in Australia, working hammer and tongs. I'm seeing pictures on Facebook, and it's really cool what John's doing. Thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks always go out to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACHECT, ACHECT.org. You are the ones who will help us end the horrors of mountaintop removal in Appalachia. And the first step to doing that is to go to ACHECT.org. Go and read up on the science, read the bill, understand what it does, understand what mountaintop removal is doing to people in Appalachia. That's why I got so absolutely pissed off with that crass comment from John Stewart. Learn what is being done in the name of your energy and the cheap Chinese crap that we buy. And it's being done here in Appalachia. Learn. ACHECT.org. Then take action. Reach out to your member of Congress, your senator. Tell your member of Congress you want him to sign on to the ACE Act, H.R. 526, and tell your senator you want it introduced in the Senate of the United States. That's you doing it is the only way that we're ever going to make it happen. It is the power of the people united. And always, always, always. Gina, it's all for you. And Rick Smith is on the way up next on The Horn.